Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Got each other on our side, plus all the folks at Fried, the Burnout Podcast with Kate Donovan.
You deserve more than feeling constantly fried to a crisp. Welcome to Fried, the Burnout Podcast, where you get the understanding, the community, and the information you need to end burnout for good. I'm your host, Kate Donovan, and all of my work focuses on hashtag ending burnout culture. Outside the pod, you'll find me on stages at conferences giving keynotes, in offices providing corporate trainings, doing virtual VIP one-on-one work, or supporting our group program, Unfried, that is run by my right-hand woman, Sarah Vosen. Both Sarah and I have been through burnout and came out stronger, happier, and more fulfilled, and we want that post-burnout growth for you, too. Fried fam, today I have the wonderful honor of reintroducing you to one person and introducing you to a second. Today, we speak with the good doctors of Abbey Research, and they are Dr. Kristen Donnelly and Dr. Aaron Hinson. They are corporate trainers that focus on employee engagement and retention with approaches and insights that get to the root of discontent, poor morale, and miscommunication, the key factors in employee turnover. The good doctors are educators with social science PhDs. They leverage their research, education, training, and experience to help their clients build cultures that no one wants to quit. Love that line. They are the authors of the best-selling book and the book that we are digging into today, my good friends, The Culture of Burnout. This is a newer burnout book, so you might have missed it, but you will not want to miss it once we finish today. They also run the Community Research Institute at Charleston Southern University, which specializes in multi-generational workspace research and training. Dr. Kristen, Dr. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having us. It's an utter delight.
I'm so excited. Cannot contain my excitement today.
There's nothing better than that. So yeah. Today we get to talk about the book. And the book was, I know, a long time coming because I kind of was around when it started-ish.
Yes.
Right. And so I was sort of waiting for the book for a while. And this is an interesting book, just so that I don't get too far ahead of myself. The full title of the book, everybody, is The Culture of Burnout, Why Your Exhaustion is Not Your Fault. If you've been around Fried for a while, you know that I'm constantly telling you that burnout is not your fault. So this book was like a salve to me. Because here's all the underlying stuff that shows people what I've been saying all this time, that shows people the underneath of what I've been saying. But what I want to know, Kristen, I kind of know a little bit of this from your perspective, so I want to start with Aaron. Why this book and why now?
Yeah, great question. The short answer is because both of us were burned out at one point or several points in the last 4 or 5 years. We started to write a book at the beginning of last year. We did not know it would become this book. Because lots of reasons, but mostly because we wanted to write a book and we knew that strategically was the next step. And we had a lot of things to say about a lot of things. But the more we kept digging into it in the first couple months, the bigger burnout became. And it's something that we have been talking about for years on our YouTube channel, on our podcast, in trainings that we do for clients. It's something Kristen has been noodling. The phrase we use at Abbey Research is when we're thinking something through, we put it in the tumble dryer. So it's been in Kristen's tumble dryer for probably I'd say a solid 10 years, the concept, the idea of burnout and like where it came from. And within our organization, as she did a couple of trainings on it, she came back to me and she was like, you know, we really don't talk about the Puritans at all when we talk about burnout. And this is an insight into our partnership, both friendship and I looked at her and made a face and was like, no, honey, we don't. We don't. Do we need to? And she was like, yeah, they're kind of a pretty big deal. And I was like, great. What does that mean? Unpack that for me. And so we started bouncing back and forth on this idea and realizing that that was a huge chunk, like the biggest chunk missing from our conversations about burnout, culturally speaking. And so as we started to, as that became bigger and bigger, in the research prep we were doing for the book, we were like, this book just has to be about this. Because the more work we did into burnout, and research we did to see what people had written about it and what people were saying about it, the people like you were few and far between in terms of recognizing the cultural aspects of it, the shared aspects of it. And we were like, at that point, felt compelled to make that argument.
Kristen.
Caitlin.
You walked out of a training. Mm-hmm. And you were like, the Puritans.
I wish it was that simple. I think it was more, I mean, so context for everybody. I have been a studier, an academic studier of religious movements around the world for 20 odd years. So one of the most driving factors in my life is the question of how does what someone believes about the universe and higher powers, how does that affect how they live their lives? So that is just one of the questions I ask all the time. And I've been looking at this for a long time. And Aaron and I lived in Northern Ireland for on and off, both of us about 5 years, just in different phases. And that's where we got our doctorates and where we met, actually. Two girls living in Pennsylvania met on a university housing in Belfast. So, because that's how the universe works. But the more I was other places that were predominantly Christian. America is not a Christian nation and has never been a Christian nation. That's a separate rant I can do at any given time, but it is definitely predominantly Christian. There was not the workaholism that there is here. And I wondered why, especially as I shared last time and, you know, even after we've talked, I kind of forayed even deeper into a burnout experience that I've recovered from through a lot of mental health medication and real good support from family. I started realizing that one of the things was that we've never actually had, as the United States, a statement of what it meant to be American at any point in time. And so we just kept assuming what it means to be an American. And what it means to be an American is to be a capitalist. And so when did capitalism start? Well, it wasn't the Industrial Revolution like we're taught in school. Capitalism has been around since forever. Capitalism is why we committed genocide against indigenous people, because they didn't fit into capitalism. So I asked, when did capitalism first show up? And the answer is with the first white folks who showed up and stayed, which is the Puritans into what is now Massachusetts, back in the 1600s. And I was like, why did they bring capitalism? Because they could have brought anything. And I started digging into their theology, and their theology is capitalism. And it is, there's a lot to it. It's
that
really,
sentence
really,
again.
Their theology is capitalism.
What does that mean?
Great question. So what we call what they believed is anyone who knows theology or has been through a Christian history class, it's Calvinism is what they were. A Dutch Reformed church is kind of what they were. And there's a whole host of nuances, but three of the main tenets of their theology is that three of the main tenets of capitalism. So one of them is that you are only a good person if you are a hard worker. The second is that you are only a hard worker if you do it alone. And the third is that sleep is for when you are dead. And so this thing that they carried as to, this is what we have to do to have relationship with our deity. This is what we have to do to be in good relationship with God. You do all of those things, it turns into resource accumulation. And resource accumulation is the basis of capitalism. And so as Aaron and I started looking at how that evolved through American history. I mean, everything to like why we have front or back porches at different times. Like, we started realizing that this strain of, we fundamentally as Americans believe you cannot be a good person if you're not a hard worker, is a specifically interesting, like other cultures believe that, like we call people lazy all over the world, but we don't have a social system, a social safety net here, because anyone who needs it is a bad person. Anyone who needs it is a moral failure. That's the narrative, especially propagated during the Reagan administration, but one that we've believed for a long time, or he wouldn't have been, that administration would not have been able to exploit it. It was already baked in, this belief that you have to be a good person. You have to work hard to be a good person. And like I said, I mean, we say it in the book a lot too. There are shades of this in other cultures all over the world. We are never going to say America is the only culture that has burnout ever, because that's a lie that someone would use to sell more books, and that's not who we are. But what we will say is there's a specific flavor of it here that is so tied to the wellness industrial complex and the process of making money for other people that we need to call that out. And so that's kind of where we start the book, honestly, is with a whole lot of dead white people.
As soon as I saw the word Puritan come up, I laughed to myself in the book. It was like literally an out loud giggle. It was a literal LOL. Because one of the things that we share on the podcast quite frequently, and one of the things I talk about in keynotes almost always, is that two of our top 10 American values are hard work and individualism. And here we are, mm-hmm. back to the same conversation, right? And yep. How are we supposed to not burn out if we're supposed to burn out?
Yep.
If that's the rule.
Yeah.
It's like, when we had all these... not new discussions about systemic racism, going back to kind of 2020, the reemergence again of those conversations. And you had a lot of people being like, oh man, America is broken. Like, the system is broken. And you had people who had been studying and working and being activists in that field for a really long time being like, no, it's working exactly as it's supposed to.
Yeah, this is a feature, not a bug.
It's the same thing with burnout culture. Like, oh God, America's so like you said, like, how are we not supposed to burn out? We are supposed to burn out because that's what the culture wants us to do. It wants us to produce until we can't anymore. It wants us to make, it wants us to do until we can't anymore.
Like machines.
I mean, like burned yeah. out husks of human beings.
Yeah. Yeah. My husband was raised in the UK. And one of the things that we've talked a lot about is the very different perspectives on retirement that we were both raised with. And so now, I mean, I'm a millennial. I will never retire because that's what millennials are no longer allowed to retire, which is a delightful joke and also a really crippling, terrible social truth. But John was raised in a culture where he paid into his pension from the minute he turned 18. And he was going to be able to retire at 65. It didn't matter if he was going to be quote unquote productive. It didn't matter anything else. He could retire at 65 and that's it. And the first time he lived in the United States, which is before we met, he was a part of a conversation where people were like really excited and thought it was adorable that senior citizens were working as Walmart greeters. And somebody else pointed out, like, that's not necessarily their retirement job. Like, they might have to be doing that because that's the only way to make ends meet. And he says it blew his mind. Like, it had never occurred to him that you would have to work until your 80s. And it wasn't like some sort of choice. And I think about that a lot along the same lines as like when we all celebrate people who had to do GoFundMes for other people's childhood cancer. It's like, that's adorable and a terrible feature of our system. But yeah, I mean... That is, gosh, America just thinks that the solo, the individual, the myth of the individual hardworking hero is the archetype we should all live up to. And not only is it a lie, but it kills a lot of us every year.
Well, and I think it's important to, it's like A, the hero, and B, the more destitute you are, the more we celebrate you when you break out of it. So the worse you start off, the more we're going to celebrate you. And it's something that I've seen happening with the conversations about privilege and other things. We have a lot of people almost lying about their backgrounds to prove that they've made it far enough to be valuable of respect.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we also really love other people's trauma as a culture. We really, really love other people's trauma, which I don't think is an American thing. I think that's a human thing.
That's a human thing. So, yeah.
As Kristen was kind of explaining the origins of burnout and talking about all the things that we found in the American story that make us the global leaders of burnout, if you will, the most burned out country in the world. You know, obviously individualism, because it is our top cultural value, was always going to factor into that. And as we just started kind of bandying back and forth ideas about, okay, so what does, like, how do we reinforce this idea of individualism throughout the history of our country and this myth of the self-made man was one of the things that we kind of latched onto. And the attachment of that to resource accumulation as well, when you get manifest destiny and the idea that the West was an uninhabited land full of resources that all the white men could take, when that's the furthest from the truth that could possibly exist. But, you know, nations are built on these kinds of myths and ideas of what it means to be an American. And, you know, one of the things that we found some really weird things throughout the course of this book, which I loved. But one of them was, I ended up finding a whole description on the etymology of the phrase, like, pull yourself up from your bootstraps.
Yeah.
Because it's one of the, you know, we all know it. It's ubiquitous. We use it all the time. And it, to your point, Caitlin, it's, you know, that we valorize these stories of people who have pulled themselves out of unbelievable circumstances to the point that people exaggerate those circumstances at times in order to get rewarded by society or to be accepted by society. And as we were looking into it, we learned that originally the term pull yourself up by your bootstraps was used to mean an impossible feat, because it's not possible. Physics, it's not possible to pull yourself up from your bootstraps. And you know, this guy had done a long form article, I think for the Nation magazine, where he explored that and kind of looked at when it started to turn into a phrase that meant something that you should be able to do, because if you just work hard enough, and if you don't, there's something morally wrong with you. And that was a huge kind of door unlocked for us in terms of kind of tracing the timeline of how we got to burnout culture. And for us, you know, Kristen mentioned again, President Reagan, but like the idea that it's a moral failing is just so key. And I think one of the pieces that make it uniquely American, and as you said when we started this chat, how often you have to say to people that their burnout is not their fault.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just one of those things we all just have to keep repeating, because it's baked into our culture that your worth as a person is determined on how hard you work and how productive you are. And so therefore, if you don't meet these unattainable levels of production, it is your fault.
Mm-hmm. Well, and productivity standards is a hard thing these days, I think. There's a couple other things that I want to get back to, but I think this is important. We are not in, like you said, Kristen, earlier, we're not in the Industrial Revolution anymore. So we're not counting how many motors you can get off the track or how many chocolates you can. I just saw like Lucille Ball in my head, you know. Like, we're not talking about actually super measurable output at the end of the day, because we are in a knowledge culture. We're in a knowledge space at the moment. So that I think this is something that I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about, but it's really hard to measure your productivity when you're someone like me.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I produce a podcast. So I guess if I produce it every week, then that counts towards my productivity. But
So one of the things is that I do want to offer, like, you are definitely in knowledge, but like, I co-own a manufacturing company. Yeah. So there are still quite a lot of industries in the United States that do still want to run on quotas and run on those stats.
Yeah, but of course. It's just not the way it used to be.
Not the way it used to be. But yeah. About to say, even within that, we have to have different conversations about productivity. And so I think for me, as somebody who, is a recovering, and I mean this in all, like, not in a Hallmark way, but like a recovering workaholic, like somebody who is learning boundaries again, what I have started to do is not like manage my productivity necessarily. Like, I still create my own metrics. Because I do have to report to other people. I have to tell Aaron what I've accomplished. I have to do all those kind of things where I'm part of two different teams and two different companies. What I have done the work to do personally over the last year, that I will do probably until I die, is to remind myself that if I don't accomplish things that are not time sensitive, it does not matter on the great scheme that it used to.
Yeah.
So I'm not like, I mean, we both fall into the trap, Aaron and I, when we do trainings, of like telling people to rest and reminding them that rest is productive. And then I like hate that word coming out of my mouth. Like, aren't we telling people everything doesn't have to be productive? So I've been wondering lately if I kind of have to like leave that mental experiment and just say, we're going to use the word productive, and being productive is not a bad thing. So
it's
how
not.
Do we strip? Yeah. How do we instead strip the moral value out of productivity and
right.
the judgy shame out of productivity?
Which I think is hard, because for so many of us, it's hard to measure right now.
Absolutely.
Right? So this is what I meant. I didn't mean that we should be able to measure it because that makes us worthy. I mean, because of the fact it's difficult to measure, it has us questioning whether or not what we're doing is valuable, because that's the measure we've always used, and not everybody can use it right now. So it's a really confusing measure. So you put yourself in this place of trying to do more of nothing, almost like just do more for doing more, because you can't.
Yeah,
you don't have a new measure.
Yeah,
right. And I don't think you need a measure, but that's how our brains are programmed because of these cultural things. That's what I was saying. More like,
got it. I'm sorry, I misinterpreted that.
No,
that's
okay. That's okay. But it's still important. I think another thing that I want to get to is, you said, Aaron, you know, what is it that we're doing that encourages this individualism to continue? And you were talking, you went, of course, the book is about the culture of burnout. So you went to the cultural explanations behind that. But the first thing I said in my mind was, we participate in individualism and we don't ask for help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. So, and this is not our fault that we do this, and also our work to move away from, because no one can change this for us. Like, that culture doesn't shift until we shift it, and we shift it by doing it differently. So this is one of those, like, really, this is a very sticky place between at the connection between individual and culture, where when I say that this podcast exists to hashtag end burnout culture, right? That's the thing. End burnout culture. That's my statement that I've been saying for 5 years almost. When I say that, I know that on a larger scale, I mean making some of these changes, these cultural shifts that will be helpful. But I also mean that as individuals, we stop participating in it as much as we possibly can, with as much power as we have within the system that we're in. Of course, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whenever I read anything that says, like, we're limitless, it makes me want to punch people through the wall. I'm like, no.
Same. There's like, there's only so much. I mean, like, when we talk to companies about how they can create cultures that mitigate burnout, which is what, you know, we spend a lot of our lives doing right now. And this is to steal a line from Aaron, one of Aaron's favorite bands. We just emphasize that it has to be tiny changes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
1,000%.
And that, like, you overthrowing governments is for groups, not like individuals.
Exactly.
So, like, we got to do tiny things.
Can I, if you're listening to this right now, can you rewind that and like highlight it by playing it again, probably 6 times, because I say that almost every episode and I need you to hear it from as many people as possible. The small things that you are doing to shift your life away from burnout are adding up together exponentially. There are a minimum of 10,000 people listening to this podcast in the next 20 days. A minimum. If all of you make a 1% change in your life away from burnout culture, we actually start to make change.
Yeah. Because, and I think that's such a, I love the way that you phrased it, Caitlin, in terms of kind of the tension between cultural change and individual change. And like, yeah. They have to coexist.
Yeah.
But, you know, to even just reference the kind of cultural change we were talking about earlier with systemic racism, everyone was like, oh, well, we have to do all of these really big things. We have to end racism now. And, you know, by doing all of these big things, and Kristen and I were sitting there going, but it has to be the small stuff. Like, we're never going to end racism by doing these 3 things that everyone tells us to, because if you don't address it on an individual level, if you aren't prepared to be reflexive, and to practice self-awareness, you're not going to make those changes. You can't do one or the other. It has to be the little things that you do. It has to be the tiny changes on an individual level. And understanding, I think, on top of that, that it takes work. It takes time. You're not going to be good at it. This is not another thing that you can perfect. Like, burnout recovery is not another thing that you can become a master of, because you're a human person with a lot of messy emotions. And a lot of other factors, a lot of other factors happening in your life,
yeah,
that can impact you on a day and daily basis. And like, you just have to give yourself the grace that like, some days you're going to be shit at it.
Yeah.
And for us, that's the biggest thing that we come back to when we, you know, we do the big, what is the culture of burnout? But then we always bring it down, because we're standing in front of individuals in rooms when we talk about this. And we're like, okay, so here's some things you can try yourself, and know that like, some of them aren't going to work. Like, that's for us, the part of it that is so toxic now. And like, I just saw something yesterday that when we're recording this, which is towards the end of January, statistically, I think yesterday, the 22nd of January, was the day that most people are likely to abandon their
resolutions,
their New Year's resolutions, which is 3 weeks into the year. And we're both, Kristen and I, are not believers in the efficacy of resolutions at all, because there's so much pressure that comes with it, that we're inundated from our culture of wellness. Like, the number of Nutrisystem advertisements I've gotten in the mail in the last 3 weeks, all of that pressure from capitalism, to bring it back to that, you know, burnout culture is capitalistic. There's all that pressure to, this one thing will fix your problems. Oh, you need to lose weight. Oh, you need to try yoga. Oh, you need my specially crafted bath bombs. And it took both of us, Kristen and I, quite a while to get around to, and we still feel the pressure all the time, to be, oh, maybe I do need to lose weight. Oh, maybe I should try that supplement. And you have to be willing to play that game with yourself, and willing to be like, what does my body need? What do I need in my life? I'll try this, see if it works. I'm a huge yoga practitioner. Kristen tried it when I was like in the middle of it, and she was like, this is not for me.
Nope. Loathe it entirely. Cannot. Nope. That's nope.
It does not work for her at all. And so, you know, I think that's the thing that I would say too, is as you're thinking about individually things that you can do to end burnout culture, you have to be willing to be experimental, and you have to be willing to accept that things aren't going to work for you. And that does not mean you're a failure either, even though as a culture, we are conditioned to believe that if you don't like yoga, there's something wrong with you, because everybody's trying to sell you something. So for me, that's what I would add to the individualism, is that like different people are different.
My listeners are cheering right now, because I tell them all the time, you don't like a piece of advice you hear on this podcast, don't do it. Don't involve in it. And also, when you start something and you find that it works, if it starts to unravel and work less over time, you're allowed to let it go and move on to something else. And you're allowed to even to go back to things that didn't work for you before that might work for you now. Like, Kristen, we don't know. Maybe you're going to turn 70 and turn into a grandma yogi. Like, we have no idea. You might.
Let's not push it, Caitlin, but okay.
Listen, we don't know. Right? This is the thing. Yeah. Like, it's okay to, I think this is something we say about boundaries around here a lot too, that like, most people have a hard time with boundaries, because what they would like would be to have a list of rules, like a book that says, like, these are my boundaries and they are always the same and they're always consistent and they never change. And if I just follow these rules, then I will be safe and okay all the time, like very robotic. Yeah. But your boundaries change based on how much sleep you had, and if you're with someone you love or with someone you trust, or if you're not, or if your boundaries will change a million times a day. And I think this idea that you're talking about, Kristen, this individualistic, like, hey, try something out and change it if it doesn't work, this relies on something called interoception, right? Interoception is our ability to reach into our bodies and understand and be self-aware almost on a biological level, which most people who burn out have low levels of interoception. This is just a common biological, a commonality, right? And so part of this recovery is talking to yourself enough and listening to yourself enough to be able to waver in these decisions and make decisions and not care if it's a right one or a wrong one. Learn whether it's a right one or a wrong one in process. And I think that's a like, the whole time I was reading the book, and there you have this social science background, and I'm a biologist, you know, like I'm a biopsychosocial gal. So I kept being like, but the biology too, right? Yeah. Like, when we're talking about, you were talking about making these small changes to overcome racism, especially on an individual scale, there are hormones in our body that make us other people.
Yeah.
Not make us different people, make us actually dehumanize others and separate them from ourselves. People know this hormone as oxytocin, as the love hormone. Unfortunately, it has a dark side that no one likes to talk about, right? But when we are going through these things, what we need to understand is that there are sociological factors, there are cultural factors, there are physiological factors, there are biological factors. And so, of course, it's going to take practice and time, and you need to see if something vibes, because you can't make changes in your physical body if it doesn't feel right and good to you.
Yeah.
Because here's one of the crappiest things about the system we live in right now. We are told to be entirely individualistic and to never trust our own instincts.
Right.
That someone else has...
What a conundrum.
Knows us better than we know ourselves. And that's particularly gendered. Women and non-binary folks have... are much more targeted with that than cishet white guys. Although I know enough cishet white guys that they feel the same thing too.
Yes.
It's just the targeting is more overt.
The propaganda is more overt.
Thank you. That the propaganda is the word I was looking for. But like that's the shitty thing. Mm-hmm. So I'm constantly told that I don't know. So I'm a fat lady, and I use that word, and I'm happy to use that word, and that's what I am. But my Instagram and my television and some of my dear friends and family who love me.
And doctors.
And doctors.
Especially doctors.
100% that they know my body's needs better than I do.
Yeah.
And I have been, because part of all of this is diet culture, which is like a whole other thing, but like a thing
within the thing. It's a
sub within the thing. Mm-hmm. I know so many people that are burned out because of diet culture.
For sure.
Totally.
But the whole, so many people are making money off of my poor self-esteem and my lack of self-concept. And that's like, that's the one of the terrible conundrums of being human. Mm-hmm. Is that we are never, I'm watching, my brother has a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, and I'm watching them try to teach my 4-year-old niece that she knows her own body and that like they don't force her to eat if she's not hungry. Like if she wakes up hungry in the middle of the night, she'll learn that lesson. Like there's ways that she's not forced to sit down at the table and finish her whole plate. She's not forced to hug or kiss somebody if she doesn't want to. And those are things that my parents are wonderful, wonderful parents, but that wasn't the parenting narrative in exactly. The year of our Lord, 1985. So they didn't, when I was 2, and they didn't know. So I'm excited that we're changing some of that narrative. But for those of us that have been baked in this thing for a few decades, it's like hard pass. Like it's just is my response to it all. And it's one of the reasons that we do tiny practices. And I mean, I listen to your podcast, Caitlin, and I've heard you say it a ton of times. And I will say that there are wonderful places for footnotes of biology, but the second edition of the book, we'll figure out how to write one together. Cause I think the other thing that's missing from the burnout narrative is one that marries both of these things.
Right. Exactly.
And so that's another step, but none of us really know what we're doing as humans.
At all.
There isn't, ever. No matter how many like pages of self-help manuals have been written, there's not actually a manual. And we are all, and again, I quote Aaron, one of Aaron's favorite pieces of pop culture, this movie that she and 2 other people have watched called Must Love Dogs. And the phrase they use is that every human is a unique constellation of attributes. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very true. And I think the very first step to figuring out how to do this journey is to remember that being a human means you don't know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And you get to fumble and mess it up. And your life is written in pencil. Mm-hmm. We get told a lot that it's written in permanent marker and that these decisions, especially again, as Americans, we start getting told when we're 12 that we have to decide college because college will determine the rest of our lives. Which is utter bullshit. Bullshit. I went to a college none of you could find on a map, and I am living the life that I dream that has nothing to do with what I did at that college you can't find on a map. So my brother never finished college and is living his dream life. But we start getting told when we're when our brains are not cooked, when our baby brains are not cooked, that things are permanently set. Now, there are things that when they change, they'll leave scars and they'll leave trauma and they are really fixed things in our lives. But even within that, you get to write your own experience and you get to write your own perspective on that a lot more than we ever say you can. And yeah, Aaron and I get to work with college students. And my favorite thing when they come and they're having their quarter life crisis, which we all had in our mid-20s on some level. And I get to look at them and say, it's okay that you don't know what you're doing. It's okay because no one does. We are all just figuring it out as we go along and we can ask for help. We have to, because none of us know what we're doing.
Well, and I think it's important to you said like, this is all written in pencil. And I think that there's the things that we feel are written in Sharpie. I'm not even going to go pen. We're going to go all the way to Sharpie because you can't get that
permanent marker.
It can't get that out of anything.
Yeah.
The things that you think are written in Sharpie, I think, is a really wonderful place for exploration. Like, is this me, or was this gifted to me through culture, parenting, narrative, society? Mm-hmm. Is this actually, like, this is a silly example and one that I've used before and doesn't have any major bearing on my life, but is an example nonetheless. When I moved to Poland, I was, apartments, Europe, much smaller than what we would typically see in the States. I grew up in a small apartment in the States, but that's not a normal scenario. And because things were set up the way they were set up. There was shelves above a washing machine in the bathroom, and not a washing machine and a dryer, just a washing machine because there is no dryer, right? And then you have the shelves above. And the towels, I wanted cabinets there instead of shelves because I wanted to be able to close it. And so my husband had cabinets put in, and I was folding the towels the way that my mother always folded towels. And they didn't fit in the cabinet. And my initial response to this was to be mad at the cabinet.
Right. I've been there. I was perpetually mad at freezers. Right. Like the whole 5 years.
Exactly. Right. So instead of one of the reasons I harp on resentment all the time and talk about anger all the time is because this can really clue us into small things that we can actually shift and have control over in our lives that make a big difference long term. And it took me months, literally months, to realize that I could fold the towel a different way. But my parents had owned a laundromat when I was a kid, and my mother folded towels a very particular way because that's how they fit well at the bottom of the bag of other people's clothes that I was folding on Saturday mornings in order to create a foundation so that the rest of the bag, when it was stacked up with their laundry and tied this, you know, clear cellophane plastic bag, that it would stand upright when my father was delivering it. So I'm stuck and angry at a cabinet because of a towel. Because my mother worked in a laundromat.
Yeah.
There's a lot of these things in your life that you are holding on to, not because they are part of you. They're not even penciled into you. They're just the outside story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. For me, and you know, I talk about this in the book, and I know Kristen, when she was on your podcast earlier, shared her kind of burnout story. But for me, I'm a caregiver for my mother. So I live at home with her, and I didn't ever really kind of articulate caregiver burnout as a thing until I started researching for the book. And we both kind of, as we're researching, we're like, oh shit, that's me. But I had to. It was such a helpful process for me to go to think through what things I thought were permanent marker that were pencil.
For instance,
yeah. So, and I tell this story in the book, like at no point in my life had anyone in my family ever told me that I had to do things by myself, that I couldn't ask for help. We tend to, my mother raised my brother and I to be maybe more private with personal things in our lives. But certainly, I was never given the message that, like, you have to figure this out on your own. But when I started, like, into more full-time caregiving, that's what I told myself. That was the tape I played in my head, as to borrow Kristen's phrase. The tape in my head was just like, oh, I live here. Like, I have 5 more minutes. I can just do it. If I just get up on commercial breaks, I can get this done. Like, I'm only 40 years old. I'm young. I can figure out, you know, I can find more energy. It was all of this. And I have my brother. There's just the two of us. He lives nearby. And we're both relatively progressive people, especially when it comes to gender roles. But as we were writing this book and I was talking to my mom about it, we realized both her and I had kind of embodied gender roles and gender norms that meant, like, we shouldn't ask my brother to cook dinner or to do the dishes if he came over once a week. And so he comes over once a week. I was having a day where I was so far past my burnout threshold, it wasn't funny. And he came over and I just I just lost it. And I was like, I don't have anything for dinner. I don't know what we're doing. Like, whatever. So stressed. And he did it. He did the dishes. He cooked dinner. And every week after that, when he comes over, he does that. And at one point my mom said to him, she goes, well, you don't come over here to do the dishes and cook dinner. Like, that's not why you come over here. And you know, he brushed it off and he did it anyway. And we, her and I had a conversation about it later and kind of like honestly talked about like, why not?
Yeah.
And she hadn't realized those like buried gender perceptions about it. But so for me, that was the like the tape that I am constantly trying to rewrite. The permanent marker I am always trying to erase is that I should figure it out because I can. I should do it by myself because I don't want to be a bother. That's my thing. I don't want to bother anybody. I don't want to be any. Everybody else is stressed out. Everybody else is busy. I don't want to be stressful. I don't want to be a bother. And so I didn't realize how deeply ingrained that was until we wrote this book.
I know that there's a lot of people listening right now that are like, oof.
It's hard.
And I think from the, sorry, I was going to say from the outside of this, one of the things that I observed too, is that their relationship has gotten stronger and closer.
Of course.
And that, like, this is something Aaron and her brother.
Yeah.
And like Aaron and her mom too, but Aaron and her brother in particular. And that this is something like I perceive that he enjoys being helpful in this way.
Oh, 100%. And
like, that's been my story too. My experience when I've learned to ask people either for help or I am much more quick to ask for help with tasks and to delegate things than Aaron is, for the simple fact that, like, well, I have chronic pain, but I'm also, I was raised in really communal environments in a different dynamic than Aaron was. But what I'm not quick to ask for is help with my mental health at all. Mm. I hold that real tight. And when in the last year, I have not been given the option to hold it tight.
Yeah.
And in the last year, what I have noticed is that when I give people the opportunity to love me, they always step up. And I think for anyone who's listening, where your burnout is still in your brain and not anywhere else, my guess is that there is somebody whose name is crossing your brain right now that wants to help. And the idea of asking them for that makes you feel like you're dragging yourself across nails. And I would encourage you to muster up all your 5 seconds of bravery and ask, because asking has saved my life this year. And we are grateful that Erin was not to that point when she asked for help, but she easily could have been. And managing someone else's life besides your life and a full-time job is not a small thing or something that anyone should be able to, should quote unquote, be able to handle. None of us are made to build life alone. But it's, again, this capitalistic nonsense that says we're supposed to. And again, that is also like a gendered thing, as Aaron said. But there's so many different flavors of burnout, but I have yet to encounter one where you don't need help getting out of it.
Amen.
Woo. Amen. Yes. Pastor Kristen.
Well, this is, I don't know, you know, you may not know this, Erin, Kristen, you might know this, but because we release on Sundays, people do call this Burnout Church.
Oh, hey.
So you just brought us to church.
I have an ordination certificate and everything. So.
Well, it's, Kristen is, you know, obviously she's the religious expert, but she's also a deep person of faith that is a huge part of the work that we do. She is the words person of the two of us. I think it's that church upbringing and that kind of training in her. But we often would end our own podcast or sometimes our trainings with a benediction from Pastor Kristen, and she can bring it home in that way. So when y'all are listening to this on the Sunday that this drops or any other time, we're delighted to be welcomed into the Church of Burnout.
And then my aunt found a picture of a sign that said Burnout Church. It's a place that's in Colorado. And she was like, do you have anything to do with this? And I was like, no. And she's a Jehovah's Witness, which makes it even funnier.
Listen,
oh, no, I'm from Colorado, so I'm going to have to find out where this place is.
So funny. It's such a small world. So we didn't, obviously not possible to get into every topic that the book covers in an hour.
Yeah.
But for those of you who are interested, what I want you to be able to do when you pick up this book, if you are burnt out, what I want you to be able to do is release the need to fix things right away, mm-hmm. and also release the helplessness mm-hmm. that you might feel in the beginning, because these are things that you do not have the power to change tomorrow. These are things that a lot of us are, like we said in the beginning, when we make small shifts, we will influence these things long term. However, a lot of them are in place and are going to be in place. And instead of allowing that to overwhelm you, I want you mm-hmm. to continue. Don't stop reading the book, because later in the book, it gives you ways to manage. It gives you ideas for shifts to make. There are these tiny shifts that are suggested, and they are in there. I do see it happen quite frequently that people that are social justice and or ecological, some sort of shift or trying to make some, you know, whatever, I'm losing the word right now, right? But people that are looking at our larger problems tend to be overwhelmed by them, and it makes them feel worse and increases their burnout.
Mm-hmm.
So what I would encourage you to do would be to dig in, knowing that every time you choose yourself, and every time you choose to respect yourself, and every time you choose to listen to yourself and respond to yourself, and every time you refuse to participate in burnout culture, and every time you notice that you just did, every time every single one of those things happens, you are shifting us away from burnout culture. That is enough.
Mm-hmm.
Kristen, Aaron, do we have parting words as we wrap up today? Are we waiting for a benediction?
Well, I'll sneak in here. And then if Kristen has a benediction in her, then it might happen. But yeah, she referenced the kind of the phrase that we use from one of my favorite bands. It's a Scottish band called Frightened Rabbit that, again, very few people know. But they have a line in one of their songs that's, "And while I'm alive, I'll make tiny changes to the earth." And like, that is my philosophy, because I am the person that gets entirely overwhelmed by the state of the world. And the more I know about it, the more overwhelmed I can become, especially as an introvert. I get really overstimulated very quickly. And for me, again, that goes back to why I don't have resolutions, because people make them too big and then they don't work and then they feel horrible about themselves. You know, for me, my kind of final takeaway that'll wrap all of those together is something that my yoga instructor actually says to us all the time, and that, you know, your body is different every single day. You are not the same person that you were yesterday, 10 days ago, 6 years ago. So it really is unlearning so much of the pattern behaviors that we have, of the societal thoughts that and pressures that we have. It's a lot of unlearning. But what has worked for me right now is kind of this, when I feel overwhelmed, what is my body telling me today? What do I need today? What does that look like? And starting from there and realizing that there are going to be days where that answer is, oh, I don't get it out of bed in the morning. That might not be a reality for a lot of other people. You know, or that looks like something else today. But this pressure that, like, we have to have all these systems in place or structures in place, that our wellness routine has to be this.
Morning routine makes me want to bang my head against a wall.
Mm-hmm. And that might work for some people.
Yeah.
I am a super routine-oriented person.
Not me.
Nope, not me.
Exactly.
Give me a morning routine. I'm looking for ways to rebel against it, even if I'm the one that created it.
But for me, I think that's what I would, my takeaway for your wonderful listeners in our burnout church is that just recognize that every day you are different. And whether you slept differently, you're with a different person, as you said, Caitlin, something else is happening in your life externally, whatever. You have a different dream that really screws you up for the morning. Like, give yourself some grace and deal with the person you are today, not the person you think you should be, or the person you were, or the person you want to be. Like, the person you are today. Start there.
So I will say, first of all, if you're listening and you were raised in evangelical nonsense and you want someone to talk to you about that, you can get in touch with me, because that's a very particular brand of burnout recovery, especially as a girl obsessed with obedience, raised in the church, find me. But when I first started talking, researching about burnout and hearing about it, every single seminar I went to just said, get more sleep, do more yoga, light more candles, and turn your phone off at 5. And one of the things that I kept hitting against was that every single thing about your body was something that my body couldn't do. And so I tried to figure out ways that I found rest. Now, some of this, I was like a brat and I refused to get a sleep study done. And like, I like wore my insomnia as a badge of honor. So like, some of this, like, I should have fixed. But the more I thought about what actual life, abundant, joyful life is supposed to look like, the more I realized that at the time, what was entirely missing from the burnout conversation was do things that make you fucking happy.
Bingo.
And that is often seen as something that is less than these other kind of serious self-care routines. I hate baths because I wrinkle. My husband has sinus issues, so we can't do scented candles. I have very legitimately, I have bipolar, I have hypomanic bipolar. Anything that involves meditation is actually toxic to my brain. I can't do it, and it's really ugly. So I had to craft other things. And that's what been talking then with Aaron and our other colleague, Eleanor, and a lot of other people, is how we came up with our framework that you'll read about, as Caitlin said at the last little bit, are kind of concrete things. But I'll spoil a little bit and say that one of them is do things that make you fucking happy. Mm-hmm. And that your joy is a non-negotiable human entity. It is not optional. It is not something we add on. It is a structural part of life. And what makes you happy is no one else's business but yours. So as long as you are not hurting yourself or anybody else, you do you, boo. I'm a Disney adult. Y'all can mock that all you want. That brings me joy. Aaron and I love Broadway. We love Taylor Swift. We both love reading romance novels. These are all things that people on Twitter will make fun of. I don't care. Because joy is part of the burnout recovery process. So my gift, my hope for you this day is that as you learn to love yourself extravagantly the way that you deserve, and as you learn to ask for whatever help you need whenever you need it, that you will remember to invite joy into your life and to construct your recovery around it.
And if you don't know what joy feels like, it is another thing that can be practiced.
100%.
It has to be, because it's not the priority of burnout culture at all. So it's another thing we have to prioritize and practice.
Well, that was a joy and a pleasure. Fried listeners, I know that there was a lot that you got from this, and you know that my favorite thing to do is to ask you to hop into the Facebook group and let me know what you're thinking about, what resonated with you, what you need to dig into more so that we can do it together. I can't wait to hear what your feedback is on this one, because there's so many things covered, and yet we're still coming down to the same principles that we talk about all the time. You, how you interact with yourself, how you interact with the world, and how you connect with the people around you.
Mm-hmm.
Right, fam. I love you dearly. See you next week.
Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Got each other on our side, plus all the folks at Fried, the Burnout Podcast with Kate Donovan.